From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 397, recorded live Thursday, November 7th, 2013. This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at TELERIK.com. And by Franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft's Kinect for Windows developers. Details at GesturePak.com. In this episode, Scott moderates a live panel at the Angle Brackets Conference in Las Vegas, where he asks the question, what will web developers need to know in 2014? With guests Douglas Crockford, John Papa, Denise Jacobs, and Michelle Arubus-Damante.
Hi, friends.
Hello, Scott.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm lovely. Aren't you guys looking lovely today as well? Are you guys having fun? So this panel is actually a selfish panel because I have put this panel together because I want to know what I need to learn in 2014. This is not for you people.
Okay.
I'm starting to feel overwhelmed. There's too much going on in web development right now. So the goal here is to try to get a sense of what are the things we want to focus on. Those things may be tools, they may be frameworks, they may be mindsets, they may be architectural considerations. So we've assembled a group of folks here that would be able to talk to that. Denise Jacobs, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm lovely. What kind of things do you focus on?
I focus actually on creativity and work and how to work better so you can create more and create betterness. My background is front-end web design and web development, but I've moved more into this other area.
Mm-hmm. John Papa.
Hey, Scott.
That is a lovely shirt.
Thank you.
You have been upping your shirt game conference to conference to the point where I'm just ashamed.
That's where you are.
I'll let you borrow it.
You will. That's fantastic. What kind of stuff do you work on? I know that you do Angular and front-end web development, also something called Hot Towel.
Hot towel. Going to go to a spa with that one.
Yeah?
Yeah. So, yeah, I do a lot of web development. Mostly I try to keep up with what's new and cool and where things are heading.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Bustamante?
I want to know what a hot towel is.
Me too.
That's his front-end web development platform.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I focus on really any cloud type deployment technology. Azure is one of my major focuses. Security related, of course. And, you know, really just user-driven design and experiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Douglas Crockford, discoverer of JSON and architect at PayPal.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
We are happy to have you here.
Yay.
We talked a little bit in a podcast yesterday, you and I, about people having maybe a missing pieces of history that they need to be thinking about.
We don't have nearly a good enough appreciation of our own history in our profession. It's something I'm trying to fix.
Cool. So I am trying to think about kind of like planning my personal strategy for learning. And is it something as simple as I should just follow noun.js, whatever that new noun is, and that's it? And all I need to do is just learn the new hot JavaScript library? Because it was jQuery before, right? And that kept me in, I kept getting jobs with jQuery. Or do I need to change the way that I think about my job? Denise?
Well, I actually think that it's more of really having a system for understanding how to learn things. You guys probably already do have this, but then also having ways of, you know, when you're having moments where you are getting blocked and you're not being able to come up with ideas, kind of having some kind of tools and some tools in your kit and some things in your arsenal to be able to deal with working through mental blocks and working through creative blocks so that you can come up with new ideas and then actually take in information better and put it together in different ways and come up and innovate. Because actually one of the most important things I think that people are going to need moving forward is the ability to innovate and having kind of confidence about your skills around innovation and being creative.
But I have a pile of books on my desk that is a monolith to my own failure. And it is a list of books that I tell myself I'm going to read this year. And every once in a while, I'll take the Ruby way and I'll put it up on the top and I'll rededicate myself to getting through that one. Or JavaScript, the good parts, which I have read the first half several times, but it's just that last half that I keep having trouble with.
Maybe that's not the good part.
do I just make, what do I do with the monoliths of shame? I'm not, I think we all feel like that, don't we? We all have those books, those libraries, those tools that we're trying to learn. John, what do I do to work through that personal crisis?
You know how many books, technical books, I read a year?
No.
Close your eyes and say, what do you see?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nunca.
I've given up on that approach. It used to work for me real well, but it just takes too long to digest where everything is in a book these days for me. So what I tend to do is I had to find a way to filter out what do I need to be aware of and what do I need to pay attention to. And those are two different things. And there's a level of awareness that I think we all need to have of what technologies are out there, what personality styles, what new themes like usability and user experience, you know, understanding what we've learned in the past and where we're heading towards in the future. But you don't need to be deep in those things. And then identifying from those which ones are really getting momentum and are going to help me in my career that I need to dive deep into. Now, in the past couple, say 6 months or so, I've dove really deep inside of like Angular to figure out where is that heading. There's a lot of momentum behind it and going down there. But I've kept my finger on the pulse of more things as an awareness level. And I find that things like Twitter, quite frankly, are very helpful to just kind of keep the pulse on what's happening out there. Even if you don't contribute, just watching where things are. And then it's time to dive into a book. And once you decide to figure out that you're going to go down the JavaScript road, for example, first thing you do is obviously read Douglas' book on JavaScript, The Good Parts, and read about the patterns for JavaScript and figure those things out, whatever that technology or pattern might be.
But if I listen to the web and I read things like Hacker News, you know, they're telling me how people in the Silicon Valley develop software, which may not necessarily be how we're doing it in my office. They're maybe using web forms from 10 years ago, and we just got permission to use jQuery. When you say you explore libraries on the side, are you trying to build real apps, or you're just kind of fooling around? You know what I mean?
Both, yes. So, yeah, I do a lot of stuff on the side where one of the companies I work with, a large entertainment company, which has a mouse as an employer, will let me do things on the side to figure out what kind of things can we do, but may not necessarily be for something at work. So it does take time to figure those things out on the side and play with them, but then I also take those and take real applications that we have and actually try to map them out and figure out how do I build that with this, and is it feasible? And sometimes, quite frankly, it's the wrong technology solution.
How much time should I spend doing this?
Yeah, you know, a couple things that you're saying resonate, because there are going to be people that just really can't, in their office, use the latest and greatest. Mm-hmm. It's a reality. So the thing that I always tell people to do, and I think this is what I did when I was, you know, moving in my career, is, you know, I made deadlines for myself. For me, maybe that was writing an article, and today that would be a blog post, you know, or trying to take on a new technology to speak about, because it will help me dig into that technology while in the meantime I have deadlines at work. So at the end of the day, if you don't have a deadline or put something on yourself, you might not be disciplined enough to explore that new thing. But a way to try to inject that into your office would be for you to take your spare time, whatever it is that you're willing to spare, you know, and every week commit a certain amount of time, a couple nights a week, maybe a little bit every weekend, to forward yourself on something that might apply to your company. So let's say you have a boring web forms, you know, implementation. And there's nothing, I didn't mean boring. Sorry, anybody. let's say you have, you know, a web forms app and you can't get out of it, but you'd like to see, well, how would that compare in MVC, right? What would that look like? So take your own time, take a slice of the project, do a little thing on your own, and then show your boss, show your team, whatever. But you did it on your own time, and you say, you know, I was just playing with this, and I was realizing, you know, if we wanted to migrate from here to here, it might not be that bad because I've kind of already figured it out on my own time. So what do you think, you know? It's one suggestion, but just a way to try to introduce the new stuff that is relevant to where you work today, rather than just the cool latest and greatest.
Douglas, what do you think? Sometimes I feel that the young people are kind of reinventing the wheel.
Those young people, yeah.
Sorry.
Crazy kids.
So we're in a period of massive innovation right now. You know, in 2000, when the dot-com bubble popped, all innovation in this area virtually stopped, and stopped for several years, almost a decade. In some ways, it was a lot nicer then because none of this stuff was changing all the time, and so it was pretty easy to keep on top of it. What we're seeing now is a lot of change. Not all of it is necessarily beneficial or is worth the cost of the change. You know, so JS.js just came out, and it changes everything. And in fact, it's about that much different than the other thing, except it's completely different, so you have to throw out everything and start over. There's not much value in that. So I think that the value is in understanding the principles, the things that are not subject to fads, which are not going to be obsolete tomorrow. And if you keep on the principles, then you can weed out the rest of it, and it makes more sense.
And I would also want to say that I think there is, it's important to kind of be able to keep yourself from just being seduced by the new and shiny, right? Like, there's always going to be a new and shiny, and there's always going to be the thing that everybody says is all the rage, but, you know, the aphorism that your parents probably told you, just because everybody's doing it, does that mean you're going to do it too? Mm-hmm. Is actually very true. And so, you know, sometimes it's really good to kind of have the moment where you observe and you look at it from a distance without entirely diving in. Maybe look into it, check under the hood, kick the tires, but don't actually commit to getting in the car and driving it.
Well, what if I'm not confident in my own code smell, my own ability to smell if something's a bad idea? What you're describing intellectually makes sense, but I might look at the way that, that some new application runs entirely in the browser. You know what I mean? Like where an application like a Gmail or something like that, where they commit to putting as much JavaScript responsibility in the browser. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. It seems like a good idea. Do nothing on the server. Servers are dead. MVC is dead at all in the browser now. That is new and shiny, but I don't feel like I have enough experience to be the one to make that judgment. What if I pick wrong?
I think there's a balance to be had there, because what you're saying is a trend that is going to continue very, very strongly, and that is the HTML5 with, you know, JavaScript, more and more JavaScript is going to be how people build apps. And part of the reason is there's going to be what? Something like, I read a statistic on Gartner, I think it was something like there's 8 billion people in the world, or, you know, projection in the next few years, and there's going to be like 50 billion devices.
I'm not quite sure how that math works.
That's really crazy, right? Like, yeah. People have multiple devices all over, and you can imagine there's people in the world that don't have any devices. So that's a prediction, right? It's just something like in the next 5 years or something. But the point is there's going to be so much mobile, and there's still going to be chaos in mobile. There's still going to be chaos in how we develop for mobile. And the only thing that works, you know, sort of cross-platform really well is, you know, JavaScript investment with HTML5 and CSS. So I'm not saying native isn't going to happen. It is. And people will fumble through it. But there's going to be more and more and more websites that want rich and interactive experiences as well, and responsive experiences. And I think that's where a lot of trends going to be. But you still need the back end. That's more about the interactive, rich part, not so much about put all the data up there, you know?
And in fact,
you got to put the data somewhere, you know?
Absolutely. And in fact, I jump on that as well. The more mobile, the more HTML5 there is, the more there is a need for a strong back end and then a good cloud service to talk to with this stuff. Because the mobile devices don't have long tethering lines to talk to things. We're going to have these kind of resilient services that we can get to.
And tight payloads, you know, really small, fast, async. There's certain technologies that if you mastered that, you're going to be wicked, you know, popular in any job you go for, right?
Well, the really exciting part is that there are going to be 8 billion people and they're all going to be writing JavaScript.
So I'm hearing you guys say, bet on the web.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm afraid we're stuck with the web. I'm really discouraged by that. Forrester predicted in 2000 that the web was going to die in a couple of years and we'd be done with it. And a lot of people believed them, including Microsoft. You know, they abandoned IE. You know, good, we're done with that web thing. We'll get on to the X-Internet. Turned out the web survived, I think, because of JavaScript. JavaScript allowed the web become an application delivery system. That just being a document retrieval system wasn't going to ensure its survival. And, you know, so thanks, JavaScript. You know, we're now stuck with the web.
What about the people who hate JavaScript? There are those who say that JavaScript that you know is ugly and it doesn't do this, and there's not enough formality to the application delivery model.
The formality is not a problem. You just need discipline. And there are a lot of people who want to do this stuff without discipline and then complain about the results. And the discipline is hard. And so I wrote JSLint as, you know, a mechanical discipline. And, you know, if you're complaining about JavaScript being too loose or unregimented or unceremonious, you should be using JSLint because it's going to kick your ass and make your program better. Mm-hmm.
Or make you cry sometimes.
Yeah, it'll make you cry too. And you probably deserve it.
No, but it's like anything. You have to invest the time, right? I am actually only just dangerous enough with JavaScript because I do mostly the back end. But when my team sets up, you know, a lot of really cool interactive things in the client side, I can jump in and fill in places because I understand the code itself and I understand, you know, how to make the calls back. So there's going to be people that are probably going to be more like me that maybe never will be JavaScript, you know, developers. Maybe they don't have the design ideas and whatnot, but they understand how it connects and how it works. And then there's other people that really need to focus. Like, I just know JavaScript inside out. I understand the best libraries for X, Y, and Z, and I've mastered it, and I can whip that together in no time and make it safe, make it secure, and make it also handle errors, for goodness sakes, because you know what happens when the errors aren't caught. So,
number one thing we find at our company when we deal with stuff with JavaScript issues, we run JSLint, we go through it all. The biggest issue we find? Exception handling. Same stuff we found in .NET and in Java and PHP.
Shuts you down.
People just decide not to do it.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea that JavaScript applications are not maintainable when they reach a certain size? People keep talking about 100,000 lines of code being some magic number that causes JavaScript apps to be, just turn to spaghetti at some point.
You can turn to spaghetti a lot earlier than that. And you can have apps of any size in any language go to crap.
Yes.
So that statement is generally made without any documentation, without any research at all. It's just a supposition. I believe that with adequate tooling and with adequate discipline, you can write JavaScript in any necessary size. One thing which is a problem is we see a lot of stuff which is way, way too big. Bloat is a big problem in all languages, and apparently it's big on the web as well. And on the web, we're less tolerant of bloat than anywhere else because we have to ship all of that crap over the wire or through the air. And that is, for most applications, the most significant cost of the application, of delivering it.
One of the things I preach a lot when I talk to people about how they develop their apps, I often get asked, how do I develop a 1,000 screen app with JavaScript? And I say, well, take the word JavaScript off that, and I first ask you, why are you developing a 1,000 screen app as one monolithic unit in the first place? How are you ever going to iterate over this or update it or maintain it or keep going? Why not break that into logical units where you can ship pieces of the app that all work together? To the user, it's one usable app. But for you, you're shipping components of the app together. And when you break things down into their modular components, it's a lot easier to maintain, to update. Forget the language. JavaScript may be more difficult to some people, but the way I look at it is in .NET or in Java or in structure type languages, you're driving over a bridge with guardrails. If you hit those guardrails, you're going to bounce back on the road, right? That helps you do that. But with JavaScript, they just remove the guardrails. It's the same bridge. If you want to drive off the cliff, you can, but why would you? You know, you just got to be disciplined to go down those roads, follow things, follow the good patterns.
Well, they said that about C and about assembler and things like that as well, like when we move up the stack. But I'm hearing people sometimes refer to JavaScript as this wonderful high-level language that allows you to build rich, componentized applications with lazy loading. And then I see other people saying, this is the new assembler. I can get down on the metal. And when we're talking on the metal, we're talking real, pure JavaScript.
No, that's a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. So there's this amazingly clever thing called ASMJS that was discovered at Mozilla. And they found that there are certain idioms of JavaScript that a clever engine can optimize very effectively and generate machine code, which can run as fast as any other language. That particular dialect of JavaScript is a subset of JavaScript, but it's not one that any human being should write. It's way ugly, it's way complicated. Machines can do that stuff very easily, but humans should not. So we've got this ironic thing with JavaScript now that, and I think this is the first time in the history of computing that this is true, that a machine can write or translate stuff into JavaScript that will run faster than handwritten JavaScript. We've never had anything like that before.
Why is that? Help me understand that a little bit deeper.
Because of these weird idioms that JavaScript doesn't have an int type, for example. And it has this crazy plus operator which wants to concatenate. And so that makes it really hard to generate efficient code. But by putting these weird annotations into the code, which are allowed in the language, things like after a variable or a constant or an expression, you say vertical bar 0, which is a no-op. It doesn't mean anything, doesn't change the value of the expression, but it does guarantee that it's going to be an integer. And so a code generator can go, that's an integer, I know what to do. Mm-hmm. So it's a different style of programming. And it's not like a type system. It's not a friendly thing which helps you to make more reliable programs. It's almost the opposite of that. But properly employed, it makes programs go faster.
Is the fact that we have, you know, quad processor pocket supercomputers and with 2 gigs of RAM reason enough for us to start sending megabytes of JSON across the wire and utilizing it as an in-memory database?
God, I hope not.
But if it works?
If it works, people will do what they'll do. When I designed JSON, my expectation was most of the payloads were going to be a K, maybe 10K at max. It really surprises me now. I've seen people creating JSON texts many gigabytes in size. I never anticipated that.
They take their entire database and they download it to the client.
The whole database in JSON, yeah. Which
then they wonder why their data's out of sync, too.
Yeah, well, it's the whole AJAX thing. Most of us still haven't figured out how to partition the application efficiently. In the beginning, it was everything's in the server. We treat the client as a terminal. That was terrible. And then you see a lot of people now saying, we'll move everything into the browser and we'll treat the server as a file system. And that's terrible. There's this middle way, right, where you're sending just-in-time data, just enough, not sending everything. And we got hints of this in things like search results. You know, Google can find a billion things which match your query, but they'll only send you 10 of them. Because they know if they send you the whole billion, it's going to take a while, and you're probably in a hurry, and you probably won't look at more than 10 anyway. We should think about that when we're writing these sorts of applications.
People are in too much of a hurry to get code done, I think. And I think that with the whole Silicon Valley side of things, with startups, people need to be very agile and quick and get a POC done and get a, you know, minimum viable product done. And it's okay in those states to sort of just get code done, sling it. But, you know, you have to at some point come back and say, we can't ship that for real to like a lot of customers. So at what point do we take that step back and say, have I really designed this right? You know, did I really, you know, I got the data to work. It works. It's going, it's coming, it's displaying, it's working. Let's just keep fixing stuff. And it just doesn't work because you have to be an architect at some point. You have to put that hat on and think about your patterns in the app. And you can do it a piece at a time if you compartmentalize the app so it's not overwhelming. So,
as a server person who is thinking about an architect in these large-scale applications, how do you, Michelle, kind of imagine that slider bar that slides from the server doing all the work to the client all doing all the work and pick the right part, you know, the right partitioning point, the bright line of responsibility for who's chewing on what amount of data?
I think today we still have limited amount we should send the browser just because the fact that, I mean, you would end up, you know, how many times have you seen a browser hang on you?
Today.
Yeah. Exactly.
It depends on the browser.
It does depend on the browser, but we need all the browsers
to
work.
But it seems like everyone has a quad processor now. Even crappy phones have a quad processor. So everyone has a jittable JavaScript engine. I mean, the JavaScript engines are as darn near as fast as C. It's not the compilation that's the issue. It's DOM manipulation or it's network traffic. So I feel like the browser wars in the let's see who can have the fastest JavaScript engine are kind of over. And now it's more of a, like, who's going to architect the app that has the right balance of responsibility?
Well, and it's also on the server side, you can have throttle issues too, right? Because you've got maybe too many users hitting all at once. I mean, you can cause the client to, you know, have perceived performance issues, and it really is a bottleneck at the server because your same page is up downloading like 10 to 50 documents or images that display and render, and on their own it would have been fast, but the way the server-side code was written wasn't good enough to make it parallel. Or, I mean, there's just so many places in an app that can have performance issues or design issues that I don't think there's one silver bullet. It's you have to look at what you're building and take a vertical slice and at some point say, okay, where are some patterns we're seeing? Error handling patterns, you know, security patterns and diagnostics and logging patterns and data transfer patterns and paging. Like, where do those fit in my app? Because every app is different. Mm-hmm. So
I've heard a lot of complaints from customers who have said, I don't want to put things in JavaScript because then everyone can see my code. Mm-hmm. They're going to steal my stuff. The same thing happened with .NET early on. I was like, oh, you can decompile it. It's just this illusion of intellectual property. But now that I'm bringing, people are literally saying, well, I don't want to do that because there's no way to secure the web service. I use API keys, but they sniff that and they steal that. And I don't want to give them my JavaScript because they're just going to take all of that. So we're going to do everything on the server because that's the last place where they can't steal our intellectual property. Mm-hmm. Is there any validity to that argument, you guys?
Well, the validity around the keys is true because you can't really protect keys in JavaScript, but there are some tricky ways you could, you know, find a way to get a dynamic key and have a period, like a lease key or something. But you don't really want to complicate your app that way unless you really know what you're doing. So I would suggest that, you know, from JavaScript, you should be posting back to your, you know, MVC and living in the same security session with the cookie that you've already authenticated to and on SSL. And that's, I mean, acceptable. That's perfectly acceptable.
We've solved those security problems on the back end.
Right, and then the back end is where, you know, the keys are stored, the certificates to call the other service and whatnot. So that's the classic implementation that doesn't get you into trouble. And I realize sometimes people want to go out of that. But if you want to go out of it, don't complain about it because you're going to give something up, you know.
But, you know, all JavaScript code is free. And it's hard to give this crap away, right? And so worrying that someone's going to steal it, it's like...
No, that was more about the key, though, right?
Well,
yeah, there's
well,
no, two things.
You can't trust the browser to keep any secrets.
Exactly.
You don't do that. You don't put keys.
But people try. I think that's the issue. People try, and they use it as a crutch to say JavaScript equals bad because I can't put my security in there. Well, why are you trying to shove everything into JavaScript?
Well,
we have solutions.
If you're genuinely concerned about security, you're not putting keys in JavaScript and sending them to the browser.
No.
That's not JavaScript's failure.
No.
No.
Well, people are always trying to ice skate uphill. These things happen. I've noticed more and more visualizations from the user experience side, like on things like D3, where in order to get an effective visualization, one has to bring over a half a meg or a megabyte of information, and then they start using not just JavaScript, but also S3 and things like that. What about the peripheral technologies around JavaScript? Which ones do you think are winning? I mean, is SVG here to stay, and we can count on that and feel good about that? Things like D3.js for visualizations, charting, things like that?
My personal opinion is I think that's a wide open territory. I think we'll be looking at all new features over the next 6 months to a year to 2 years in that area. Obviously, CSS is here, and I think that's firmly entrenched.
CSS3 is one. We count on it. Transitions?
Transitions, that's a given. And anybody who's got a modern browser, which is pretty much every mobile device, can handle those things. But when you get into SVG and D3 and other kind of 3D rendering engines and animations, that stuff's going to evolve considerably, I believe.
It's still in the foundling stage. It's really, yeah. They're still trying to get the specs together.
That's all part of the whole sort of gamification, they call it, right, of the enterprise, right? That trend that's sort of picking up in the next few years around making the work you do more, the workflow better, making the process more effective and efficient, but making it interesting and fun so you participate. So that boring job you have, you're going to tweet, you're going to share, you're going to have statistics, and you're going to get tokens because you did a good job. And because everyone's doing it, you're going to get excited about that and love your job more. And I know it all sounds really hokey, but that's kind of the new topic that seems to be happening that probably over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see pick it up.
Now.
Oh, you got it.
I didn't talk about it yesterday.
She did talk about the gamification
business.
Hey!
But the interesting and fun for who? Probably not for the poor bastards who are going to have to use the stuff.
Not if they don't do a good job.
They're chasing the thing. Yeah, it's more fun for the developers and programmers.
Right.
Like, wow, we're getting to do 3D. You know, we used to just do pie charts, and this is great.
But it's not supposed to be a game. I think the intent, and you're right, it's going to go there, right? Somebody's going to mess it up because they're not going to be focusing on the UI. They're not going to be thinking about the user's experience. And it's 75% psychology that somebody loves something, right?
Yes.
25% technology. So that 75% has to kick it up. So everybody should be thinking about usability. How do I make this interactive, but not just interactive for nothing? Like, do people really use this, and is it working?
Yeah.
What do they think? What do you think the user wants to do next? What's their intent? And think of it before they do, so that it's just, wow, that worked. That's awesome.
I think that's where things tend to go wrong the worst, is forgetting who we're working for. So I have a list of three parties I'm working for. Number one, the poor people have to use the software that I'm writing. They're at the top of my list. I really care about them. I want to not make their lives unpleasant. I want to make it as good for them as I can. Number two, I want to make it work with the people I'm working with, even people who are going to be working with me in the future, who I haven't met yet, who I may never meet, who are going to have to work with my code. Mm-hmm. And I want to have so much goodness in my code that they're not going to hate me for what I've done to them.
Or talk bad about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they can, they'll talk. But I really do want to make their lives better. And then number three, the people who you're working for, the people who are paying you. So much of our software is labeled legacy, which means it has negative value to the enterprise. Mm. It's a liability. And I want to be producing stuff so that the enterprise is actually better off for having employed me. And most software, I don't think, qualifies to that, but I think that's what we should all be trying to get. Mm-hmm. And so trying to adopt the latest technology because it's fun, or we could put 3D in an accounting application because we can, because mm-hmm. we're bored, because we hate our jobs or our lives or whatever, and we think maybe software is the answer. Mm-hmm. It's not. You know, it's providing good service to humanity. That's the answer.
Well, I was just saying, what about the people who actually do hate their jobs and their lives because they're on IE6 or IE8, and they're hearing all of this, and they're saying, well, that's great for you, but we are back in the past, and my boss just let us upgrade to IE8.
Kind of related to this, maybe not entirely directly related, but somewhat related. I spoke with a woman who is head of HR at Groupon, and she shared a very interesting statistic with me, and that is that last year there were over 1 million jobs, developer jobs, that didn't get filled because there weren't enough qualified applicants. Yeah, like there were a lot. In other words, all of y'all should never have trouble finding a job because you are the people who a lot of people are looking for. And so to kind of talk about what you're talking about, if you hate your job and you don't like what you're doing, go find another one because it exists.
That seems like it's an exclusively software engineering and computer science kind of a thing right now. I mean, I thought the economy was in the toilet.
The economy, I'm just saying, all I'm saying is I talked to a woman who...
I'm just saying.
Look, I didn't pull this number out of my air. I talked to somebody who this is her job.
No, I hear this over.
You know, and she's in technical recruiting, and she has to work really hard to find people who are qualified to work for them. And so, whenever I hear people say, "Oh, it's hard," and this and this, and I'm like in my own personal developer hell, then I'm like, "Well, then leave."
Well, like, but it's more than leaving. We've got a lot of programmers out of work, and most of them are underskilled, that they have not kept up. And so they are not employable. There are jobs there if they could level up their skills, and they haven't.
So what do they do? Where do we level up our skills? Is it just a matter of working on some little league project and writing it in Angular and becoming proficient in Angular?
I think it is working the craft, you know, mm-hmm. writing programs, instead of watching TV and waiting mm-hmm. for the phone to ring.
Mm. It's like anything. If you don't work on it, it's not going to happen for you. One thing, I go to a lot of companies and they ask me how we do keep up to speed on these things. And one of the things I tell them a lot is, well, tell me what you do now. Tell me more about how you work, how you live, how you do your craft. And they tell me what they do. And it's funny how often I go to a company and the people in this cube next to the next person, as close as me and Michelle are right here, don't talk to each other. They might work on the same thing, but they're not coordinating mm-hmm. on this. Get up and talk to the people around you. You're the one who has the power to change what you have to do. If you want to learn something new, make it happen. Don't blame your boss because they won't let you do it. Don't go on the internet and go, well, it's too hard, I couldn't do it. Well, we can always blame forever and ever. But at some point, you got to get up and actually get involved.
This is interesting. I didn't think that the panel would turn into like a pep talk for the disenfranchised developer. But you bring up a really interesting point. I've talked about this. I have different terms. I've talked about the social developer, the idea of being a social developer. I've also used this term before, the idea of a dark matter developer. They take up the larger amount of the space in the universe. We can't prove that they exist. I'm sure that for every one of you all that are here, there's 1,000 dark matter developers. Because you're at a conference listening to a panel about software, you care about your craft, you are in the top 1% of developers by your very presence here. Mm-hmm. And the other 999 that are feeling disenfranchised, I'm hearing you say, get out there, have conversations. Pair on things. Pair with the person.
Pairing helps a lot.
Yeah, usually.
Pairing is the only reason I still have a job. I feel like pairing, when it was introduced kind of like formally like 10 years ago, just completely changed the way that I focused. I mean, I have trouble focusing, and as you can tell.
No.
And but being able to sit down with someone and just brainstorm. And even though I'm a remote worker, I pair with people remotely and just keep a whole monitor dedicated to someone just to sit there, and we can work a problem together.
It doesn't even matter if you are, quote unquote, the expert, or you think you're the expert at this topic that you're pairing on, because I find it really rewarding to take something that I think I know all the answer to and talk to somebody else who's also interested in that topic, because I can always learn something from somebody else that's done it a different way, or maybe we'll come to a middle ground, or maybe it'll prove that my theory was right. But it's cool to hear that, and it's cool to experience that, and most times something new is learned, you know, in that process on all sides. So
and not only that, even if you are the so-called expert, by going through the process of trying to teach somebody something, you up-level your skills tremendously. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know about you guys, but I hate looking like I don't know what I'm talking about. And so whenever I had to teach something, I would be like trying to find out every single last thing, so that I would know that if somebody asked me a question, that I had some kind of something in my, you know, in my bag of tricks to come back with them that. And if I couldn't find it, then that was something, gave me an opportunity to learn something else.
Douglas used a term in our conversation yesterday, software archaeology. I asked him if he was the inventor of JSON. He said, no, I discovered it. It was already there. It's playing with software, working on software, isn't necessarily that you have an inspiration and you discover something, you uncover it.
Oh yeah, so the best idea currently in software now is functional programming. It's something that JavaScript got in 99, it's something that's in C# now, Java's going to have it next year maybe. There are lots of new languages coming online which are all about that. And that's an idea that comes from 1958. And it took a really long time for it to move into the mainstream. But we're finally adopting it because it works. It is a solution to problems that we have now, like managing asynchronicity and other things that are peculiar to the future. So often we're chasing the new shiny thing, but often the thing we should be chasing is something that was invented a long, long time ago, but not adequately recognized.
How much time should we spend reading, for lack of a better word, kind of historical documents, finding historical context?
I think we should be doing a lot more of that. As a profession, we seem to have no intellectual curiosity about how we got here and what mistakes and accidents and insights and inventions led to where we are. It's not that the smartest guys in the world got in a room and decided, and this is how it'll be, and this is what we do. It wasn't like that at all. And understanding how we got here and the roads not taken and the missed opportunities and all of that. For example, one of the best guys who ever lived was Doug Engelbart, who was doing the augmentation project at SRI. Brilliant, way ahead of his time stuff, way, way ahead.
Engelbart was who did the greatest demo ever done?
The mother of all demos.
Mother of all Engelbart. Demos.
He's best remembered today for having invented the mouse. The mouse was the least of the things that he did. And we still have not caught up to his vision, although most of what we're doing now is a direct consequence of things that he was developing. There's still stuff in his vision which we haven't accomplished yet. So understanding Engelbart, going back and reading his papers, looking at his demo and going, wow, you know, how do we make this stuff real? I think that'd be a valuable thing for us to be doing.
As a brief aside, about when was the mother of all demos?
I think it was 1967. At that time, everybody was on punch cards. He was on CRTs that were networked with real-time teleconferencing and yeah, it was just hypertext.
Yeah. Go out there and Google with Bing for the mother of all demos and watch it. I think it's about an hour, 80 minutes long, and you've got multi-editing over distance with two-way video communication.
Yeah, with hypertext.
Hypertext before any of these things exist. And even now, they still don't exist in this elegant of a way.
Right. 1967.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This guy was great. It is called the mother of all demos for a reason.
It was a demo. His laboratory was in Menlo Park. The demo was conducted in San Francisco over the network. They had parties in both locations interacting.
That's hot.
So far ahead of his time.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, we should all know about this guy. It's amazing stuff.
One thing I did want to cover, I'm just going to change direction a little bit. I was talking with Christian Heilman from Mozilla about their operating system, their Firefox OS, which is all JavaScript and all web. And one of the things that I got from him was that we complain about the power usage and the power issues with our phones. And you say, oh man, this phone sucks and that laptop sucks. But we never associate the power hungriness or not with a website we might be visiting. I could have the same phone that John has, except he visits news.com and I visit CNN.com, and I don't understand why my battery doesn't last till more than 4 hours and he lasts all day. I've never once said to myself, I wonder if it's inappropriate use of JavaScript and CSS in the website I'm visiting that is causing that power issue. Are those kinds of things we need to worry about? Because the folks at Mozilla would indicate that they, in fact, are. We need to be thinking about this many watts, you know, milliwatts are being used because I chose to do a tight loop with jQuery to do a CSS animation when I could have used CSS 3 and had it happen on the hardware and the GPU. And this is literally orders of magnitude more of power. Do we need to bake understanding of power usage into the web? Mavericks has just put that kind of stuff in Safari and into the operating system recently. Any thoughts about power usage in JavaScript?
Yeah, I feel torn on that topic in general because performance is a huge issue. And performance in many factors, and battery consumption and speed is one side of it. But the other side of it is, you should be aware of certain things at the start of an application when you design any system, back-end, front-end, wherever, that you just shouldn't be doing. For example, animations, if you can support CSS3 transitions and animations, you should be using them. You shouldn't be writing JavaScript to do those things because it will consume more. And it's not just performance in the battery. It's the app and the experience and everything else. But the other side is the over-optimization of things. We can analyze things to death. And if you do that, you're going to develop an app that you're going to spend 6 months designing, and then you have no time left to actually write the app. So I generally tend to recognize with people when they are trying to optimize things, take the canned things that you know are going to make the big impact, do those, get an iteration of the app out first, see how it operates. Then when you identify this is an issue, let's go back and let's operate on that. Because there's lots of apps that don't need that kind of optimization.
You just described lean startup, so, you know.
Lean startup.
Yeah. I mean, the whole iterative process that really has nothing to do with startups, to be honest. I mean, it has to do with startups because people who are doing startups need to show progress to get the funding. They got to get something live. They got to get some people tracking and using the product. But any company, anybody building anything, in my opinion, you know, it's okay to, quote unquote, sling the first thing together to get it out there because you don't even know how you're going to end up designing it or if people like what you're doing. Mm. Don't even waste a minute on perfecting the code and the architecture till you know somebody's actually going to use the thing that you're building.
Well, as you create the perfect
product,
nobody uses.
But you have to take the time to go back, and that's where people mess up. You either... So I was an architect for what? Like, just architecture for like 10 years, and I didn't do a lot of app development. And then I went out and became part of a startup and had to actually write the code. And I built an STS, like, soup to nuts. 300 hours a month for, like, I don't know how many months, but, like, just hardcore development. And then I realized, oh, well, this is what it's like to finish stuff. Okay. So I remembered. But the point is that architecture, my first instinct is always architect first, got to design. And I started doing that with my startups. And then I realized, wait a minute, I'm like not letting us get stuff done because I'm being too anal about like how this is designed and where stuff goes. So I'm just going to stop that right now. And as soon as I stopped that, we got stuff done and things got shipped. And then we were able to go back and fix stuff. And just recently, because some customers are coming on board, took us a couple sprints and really cleaned up some things, you know, before the app has gotten bigger and too wide and too massive to manage that. So you got to find that sweet spot.
Kind of a tightrope, though.
It is a tightrope because the problem is your boss. So, you know, I'm the one making that decision saying I'm not shipping that like this. But if your boss doesn't agree that way and they just say, no, this is good enough, ship it, let's keep going, then they're going to cause that not to work. So then you have to design up front to make sure.
Douglas's point about maintainability, you may just say, oh, well, we'll ship that and we'll fix it later. And then 15 years later, some software archaeologist uncovers that code. And has to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, then you'll be embarrassed.
Which I can only hope.
But that's also where discipline comes into play. I mean, some of the companies I've been working with lately, they struggle with that. We have a deadline. It doesn't matter what we're building. We just have to get the app out by then. Well, what if we can't get all the features done? Doesn't matter. The app has to be out by this date. That's the money we have. Otherwise, it's gone. We all live in that world.
Right.
But if you can iterate through and create a version of the app and get it out there and try it, sometimes it's better to spend, let's pick a number, $100,000 for, you know, outsource some application and get it written on a platform, Android, iOS, whatever, just to see if it works and is viable, to get that feedback from the users, to find out, do you like it? We often don't get to talk to the most important people who use these apps. We design the apps based upon timelines and deadlines and money and what our boss is trying to tell us to do and when we have to get home for dinner. But the people using the apps don't often even know what they want to do until they get something in their hands.
Right.
So if you wait a year to do that, you've lost a year's worth of valuable information.
Right.
So I kind of I look at this, you know, the whole decision, that tightrope, as something that depends on what you're doing. Startups, whip it out there, but whoever's in charge, make sure you come back before it gets to be messy. In a business, when you're not the boss, you're going to have to be careful about that because somebody might say, deadline, 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 sorry, no time to fix. What I did when I was building that security product, I had to give it to customers and it had to work and it was a security product, so kind of important that it's, you know, secure. So I was in the middle of designing it and getting some features out, and I realized if I take a step back now after we added a certain number of things and just fix this and this and this and bring it together with common code base, because I saw the pattern because I was the main person seeing everything, which is also useful, by the way, to have somebody who sees the whole thing.
Sure, but that's the chief architect programming model, though, which is a luxury.
Right, it's a luxury. Yeah. But
each of you are describing luxuries, by the way. You've described being able to go and do a proof of concept and have outsourced. That's
right.
A luxury.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The luxury of the chief architect.
But I'm trying to show you only a point that I realize not everybody will sit in this position, and it might never happen to you because you're on a team, but I'm impressing the value of this, which is, I had a customer waiting and I stayed up how many nights in a row, but I purposely like just kind of said like it's going to be late. Like I just pushed it and I didn't want to push it for their sake, but I knew that if I didn't for their sake, the next thing they asked for was going to be like taking me forever because I would have had to go back and do it. So I took the executive decision and I took a step back and I was like a week and a half late working nights, weekends. But when I cleaned that stuff up, oh my God, was everything else fast. Like, I mean, you could just add features like this, like that, like bada bing, bada bang. And that's the kind of stuff that you got to tell your boss or whomever, you know, that's going to help them understand the importance of taking a step back and making time for that.
And every developer should know how to talk to their boss.
Well,
you should be able to communicate.
And it seems like with that approach, that then, you know, the way to actually make it a compelling argument for your boss is to also talk time and money. If we put this much more time into it, we will be able to save this much amount of time later and this amount of money. And if you're going to have to deal with that conversation, then you should probably understand that
and consequences too,
yeah,
as well.
Exactly.
If we don't do this, this is what's going to happen.
Exactly.
Your boss doesn't care that if we don't use Angular, I'm not going to learn the coolest new thing.
Nope.
That is a really interesting thing. The idea that underneath discipline, underneath measuring, underneath these things that you're talking about, there is a reminder, like Douglas said at the beginning, that who exactly are we working for? We're working for the user, mm-hmm, but we're also trying to support, presumably, a business. Unless we're in academia or open source for fun, we are ultimately trying to create some kind of a business. And I think it's really easy when you are several levels deep to kind of forget why it is we wrote this feature or why it is we use that library.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
Sometimes it's for the business, but we also have to be able to articulate that while it may not be a direct impact on the bottom line to get some money into the business, if a business understands, like a service organization, that by providing better service for the user, like having an iPhone that has cool apps on it, what they did was they basically engendered people who wanted to use their apps. If you can build better service, and that can translate to money too. But you have to be able to articulate that to the people. You can't just go in and say, you're wrong, you're stupid, I know best, and move along, which we all like to do.
I do want to ask a question about jQuery, because I've heard people say before that we've raised a generation of developers who don't actually know how to write JavaScript. They just don't know how to write jQuery.
Mm.
I don't want to demonize jQuery, but are those days over? jQuery served a purpose, it spackled over issues with the browser, and now we don't need to think about it anymore?
I think we're stuck with it. You know, once something gets into the enterprise, it's going to be there for a long time. And particularly after Microsoft adopted jQuery, it's going to be like a weed. It's going to take decades to pull it all out.
So you're not a fan?
I think it's great. Anything is better than trying to write directly to the DOM. Because I would, anything is better than that. And jQuery is definitely better than the DOM.
There was a time that it was needed because there was so many different variations of the DOM that you would have just decided not to do web programming like I did 4 or 5 years ago because it got so painful before jQuery came out.
So you're saying it's a necessary evil?
It was. Now it's an unnecessary evil, but we're stuck with it.
Yes.
So, do you want to translate that into actionable, or should I just paraphrase for you, sir?
Knock yourself out.
Pretty sure you guys can, like, just scale it back a little bit on the jQuery.
There's actually a talk here this week on that.
Scaling back the jQuery?
Elijah Manor has a talk, I forget the title, on do I need jQuery anymore, and I'm paraphrasing.
That's the new title, Scaling Back the jQuery.
And he would know.
Yeah, he would know, absolutely, because he works for the jQuery.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know what the conclusion is, so let's all find out.
Yeah, absolutely. We've just got a couple more minutes. Let's just go down the panel, and if you have like a takeaway or an action item or something for someone to write in their notebook or their to-do.txt file.
Let's start that way.
Let's put the pressure on Doug to give us a to-do, sir.
All right. If I could give everybody one piece of advice, if everybody would just do this one thing, it would be great, and that is, please stop making bugs.
Number one on my list.
No more bugs.
I guess, you know, to follow on from that, I would just say how the importance of being disciplined, to take a word from Doug here, and the importance of, you know, getting things done, but remembering that at some point, design is really, really important. And if you need to go to somebody to help you with that, great. Or team up with some of your peers at work, great. But get a visual on pieces of the code, vertical slice at a time, so it's manageable. And just try and think of error patterns, security patterns, all of the patterns that can help it just, you know, streamline future development to make it faster for you and also more healthy code. That would actually back you up.
Fewer bugs, I think it would help it.
So I call something a concept called the vertical slice, and I think you've referred to it a couple times as well. Getting a slice of your application working. I think far too often many of us try to figure out the perfect database, then the perfect ORM, then the perfect... We layer the whole app out trying to get everything working together, and we don't actually see any progress. It's a lot of times I look at it as, let's get a vertical slice of the app from top to bottom, see one feature of the app working. If you could do that first, a lot of times the rest of it will flow out from there, and you can prove quite a bit that way.
Denise?
You guys touched on a lot of this stuff, a lot of things that I talked about in both of my talks, and so basically I think it's really important to basically start thinking about how you can hack ways that you can work, that you work, so that you're ever able to work better, create more, and to create better things, kind of like Douglas was talking about earlier, that, you know, you're working for the users, you're working for your company, and you're working for your team. And so figure out ways that you can work really well so that you can serve all of those needs and also serve your own needs.
Very cool.
Oh,
sorry, go ahead.
And if you're looking for a job, I'm just saying, I have a feeling healthcare.gov is hiring.
And they pay by the line of code, don't they?
They need your help.
And on that note, let's give a big hand to our illustrious panel here at Anagraphics.